Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 253, recorded Thursday, June 2nd, 2016. Scott McNeely. Triangulation is brought to you by Corning. Corning's incredibly durable Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 optical cables are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to corning.com/twit to save up to $130 on their superior Thunderbolt optical cables. And by Automatic, the connected car company that improves your driving and integrates your car into your digital life. Visit automatic.com for a limited time 30% discount and free shipping on your automatic adapter. And by DigitalOcean, simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, make sure you enter the promo code TRIANGULATION in the billing section to get your $10 credit. It's time for Triangulation, a show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology, and it's really great because we get an hour just uninterrupted to talk to them and pick their brains and learn. And I always love doing this show, but I've been really looking forward to today's episode because we are really privileged to have Scott McNeely with us today. And hi, Scott, welcome.
It's nice to be here. Thanks.
I probably don't need to introduce Scott McNeely. He was, of course, co-founder of Sun Microsystems in 1982 and rode that wave and became very famous. And what I always loved, very outspoken as the CEO of Sun Microsystems. It's great to have you. What are you doing these days?
Well, I'm certainly still busy. I have a 14, 16, 18, and 20-year-old, which were 2, 4, 6, and 8 when I decided to step down from Sun. So I'm almost through the process of launching those four startups and moving on to some other things. But that's really been my primary focus over the last bit of time. But I've been doing a lot of investing, a lot of advising, and two big efforts that I've been involved in are Curriki, which is my .org, C-U-R-R-I-K-I.org. And that's basically trying to make free and open source the entire K-12 curriculum experience all on one site. And then Weigh-In is my other big deal. We started, a buddy of mine and I started it in Colorado, and we're trying to consolidate and innovate in the digital marketing world.
Must be nice to have a little time as your sons are growing up to spend with them. I'm kind of jealous.
Yeah, I got a late start. I didn't get married until I was 39, so I'm kind of an old geezer for raising teenagers. But it's nice. I've got a little more wisdom, having been able to mature a little bit myself, as well as a little time, because I put in about three careers worth of work up until the time I stepped down as a CEO almost 10 years ago now.
Wow. And I know you're a Sharks fan. Before we started, I both congratulated and commiserated.
Now, how's my playoff beard look?
You're growing that Stanley Cups, huh?
I'm not shaving or cutting my hair until we get through the cup. They're down 2-0, but I have faith. I have faith that they'll come back and make some very good things happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're recording this on June 2nd for airing in 11 days. We'll know by then. So you will either look prescient, as you have many times in the past, or we'll just have to say, that's life. We have a lot of Pittsburgh fans, too, who are rooting for the Penguins. So this is always tough. I hesitate to announce my... But we're lucky in the Bay Area. My loyalties to the Sharks and the Warriors, the Giants. Niners have been pretty good now, maybe not so good, but we've had some very good teams in the Bay Area.
I've also been caddying a lot, and I'm going to be caddying on Monday for my oldest son as he tries to make the U.S. Open for a second time.
That's exciting. Yeah. I know you're a very serious golfer.
Yeah, well, I'm avid. I'm not very serious anymore.
Avid.
My four boys are very good. I'll have two of them on the Stanford golf team next season, and then two in playing high school golf. So
I think you said you were a golf major in college.
Yeah.
So let's. I don't know where to start. Actually, I'm interested in weigh in, and we'll go a little bit backwards in this interview. When you first started weigh in. It was it's kind of social media startup. Tell me exactly what it is now and what it was then.
Well, we saw the cloud computing, the network as the computer, was going to definitely start to impact the whole marketing experience much more aggressively. We're not the only company to have figured it out. And there's lots of little companies out there doing social listening, doing analytics, doing engagement and digital campaign tools, all the rest of it. And we went after that marketplace. We thought we would be a network, a social network while we were doing that, but Pinterest and Snapchat and all the others have won. So we decided to ride and use those technologies. So we ingest the entire social media conversation in real time. We tag and index it, sort of like Google does the web. We do the social media conversation. I call it crowd noise. We index it and allow you to filter and search it and find social golden needles in that haystack. Of social crowd noise, and then apply them to authentic campaigns to do quizzes and sweepstakes and coupons and photo upload contests, all the rest of it, and provide a wonderful end-to-end cloud digital marketing experience that allows you to interact with huge numbers of clientele out there. In fact, the weigh-in today has engaged 1 in 7 humans on the planet.
Wow.
Which is kind of a stunning, 1 in 14. And we have a line of sight to getting to 1 in 7 humans on the planet. And we are capturing the first party data of those engagements. By the end of this year, we think we'll have 1 in 7 people who have engaged in our digital campaigns. So
what I like about this is you focus on authenticity. It's an unusual kind of way of marketing, something that... My friends Doc Searles, kind of with the Clotrain Manifesto many years ago, said that marketing now, it's about conversations. It's about talking to your customers directly as opposed to kind of, as you say, megaphone marketing.
Exactly right. And that one-on-one, it turns out that people trust a social post far more than they trust the marketing campaign done by the Madison Avenue ad agency.
What a surprise.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, it's very different from your start, from how you began. It's probably refreshing to try different things, new things.
Well, it's actually pretty similar in many ways in the sense that when I started in the computer industry, there were hundreds of APIs, which were the microprocessor operating system user interface binary environment. And you had to decide if you're going to write an application or add value to a platform, which one did you do? Data General? Did you do DAC? Did you do one of 5 IBM APIs? Or did you do Apple or PC or Sun or whatever? And if you think about the marketing world, we sort of have, and we ended up with what I call the Frankenstein data center, where you brought in all these little different pieces and it was very proprietary and very constrained. The marketing directors today have that same problem. They have to buy their listening tool from here, their analytics from there, their publishing tools from there, and they're building their own little Frankensteins or Franken suites, if you want to call them, in the CMO's office, and they're becoming IT directors. We're trying to put together a new age, new generation, scalable, integrated from the ground up, carrier grade, open API, clearly architected cloud architecture that allows these digital campaigns to happen. And what's also interesting, very much like in the distributed computing space where people went from the mainframe to truly distributed network computing, people today, 3/4 of the media buys are still in the traditional print and media megaphone buys. But we had the big kaboom last year where worldwide people are now spending more time in front of a digital screen like we all are right now than they are in front of a TV screen. So that big change has happened, yet the advertising and media buys and campaigns have not transitioned. So there's this massive gap between where people are spending today versus where the user is today.
Let's go back to the early 80s and the founding of Sun. You're an East Coast boy. You're not a Stanford guy, right?
I'm a Midwesterner. Yeah, I went to Harvard undergrad, but I grew up in the Midwest.
Yeah. Well, actually, let's go pre-Sun. How did you get into technology?
Accidentally. And so, you know, I worked out of college. I went economics major, golf major from Harvard. I went to work in the automobile industry. My dad was group vice president of North American marketing for American Motors.
Oh, interesting.
My first car was a Gremlin X.
Oh, God, what a great car.
Three on the floor, straight six, stripes on the side. It was, and if you dropped the clutch, you couldn't spin the tires in gravel with that thing. But it got me around. So I worked in plastics. I guess I watched the movie The Graduate, and I worked in the plastics group, and I was a foreman and a plant scheduler, reliability engineer, and eventually a sales rep. And then I went back to business school, came back to Chicago to be a strategic manufacturing person because they wouldn't put me in the factory. I wanted to be in the factory. I'd spent time before school. I loved being in the factory. I loved making things. And FMC said FMC Corporation said, if you come to corporate manufacturing staff, then we'll put you in a plant eventually. Well, I lasted about 8 months in Chicago winter and then fell in love with a gal in the tank plant. We were building armored personnel vehicles out in San Jose at FMC. And I fell in love on a project out there. And I said to my boss, either you move me out there or I quit. So he moved me out there. And I quit 2 months later to go into the computer industry. My former professor, Bill Reduschel, from Harvard, was buying computers from a company called Onyx. They were the first company to put Unix on a microprocessor in a little pizza box. Actually, it was a little bigger than a pizza box. But I got involved there. And then 10 months later, Vinod Khosla called me up and said, let's go start Stanford University Network and Sun Microsystems. And that's how I kind of stumbled into it. It was sort of accidental. It wasn't a planned strategy to get into tech or to get into computers.
It's interesting because AMC, in some ways, is the Sun Microsystems of Detroit. How much of your dad's experience at American Motors influenced your business acumen?
Well, I don't know why, but I just, he influenced me a lot. I would want to go play golf with him on the weekends, and I would, when he'd come home at night and have a cocktail, and he'd bring a briefcase home. This is the olden days.
Yeah.
He actually brought a briefcase full of, from his in-basket.
Oh, man.
And he would have all these inter-office memos, and he would write things on them. He'd have a throwaway pile, he'd have a forward pile, and he'd have a save pile. And I would read each one of the things that he would throw on the floor. I'd sit by his feet, and I'd just read them. I'd read the memos, I'd read what he wrote on the memos, I'd ask him questions about it, and I'd spend an hour a night sometimes just reading his mail with him. And I always loved on Saturday to go into the office and walk around the office and see him and hang out in his office. I don't know. It's just sort of either it's genetic or it's nurture. I'm guessing it's more genetic.
Really? Yeah. Did you learn anything from, I mean, AMC I thought was very well marketed, but always kind of an iconoclast, you know, compared to the big three, and made such really interesting vehicles like the Gremlin.
Yeah, it looked like they cut the back of it off.
yeah, crazy
and
stuff.
Then we had the Matador, which, you know, wasn't necessarily a great name because it might have meant killer down in Latin America. Killer down in Latin America. So I learned names matter. I also learned you had to kind of punch above your weight if you didn't have the advertising budget that General Motors or whatever. And it also informed a lot of what got me excited about weighing, because I remember watching a Pacer ad, and the guy was screaming into the camera, lots of glass, lots of class, and we were all laughing. And I said to my dad, I said, so, you know, that was really funny. Is that a good ad? And he goes, yeah, it has great recall.
Interesting.
And I asked him, but did it sell any cars, Dad? Ooh. And he goes, son, that's a great question. Ooh. And to this day, we still don't know when you run a TV ad or whatever. We hope, but we don't know who. We don't know how many. We don't. We don't know how effective any particular ad is. And when you move to digital marketing, all of a sudden you get provable, what I call provable campaigns and improvable. You can actually do A-B testing in real time. So I'm very excited about applying the cloud, the network computing. I mean, wouldn't it have been great if we just called it cloud instead of the network as the computer? We'd have saved a lot of words back in the old days.
It took me a long time. And in fact, to understand what the network is, the computer.
Just cloud computing.
I didn't understand it. And then you're right. It clicked for me when cloud compute. And then I go, oh, they were right all along. That's exactly right. That's what it was.
I had a Java ring, and I was super yeah. Java man on the Fortune. You know, we're now getting to wearable computing, you know, open interfaces.
Way ahead of the time.
Too far ahead in so many cases in for instance, thin client computing, I guarantee you that will come back as the cloud gets more and more powerful. And, you know, us carrying our personal mainframes is just so wrong. And if you look at the Internet of Things we were talking about, I used to say everything with a digital, electrical, or biological heartbeat will be connected to the Internet.
Yeah.
And people look at me like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, but you couldn't have been more right. Here's Java. Here's Java, man.
That's so nasty.
Son Scott McNeely must stop Bill Gates from dominating the corporate universe. Will the magic of Java save the day? Are you hanging from a string in this shot? What the hell?
I'm actually on a ladder, and they kind of photoshopped it out. So, no, actually, I could fly back then.
Oh, yeah, back then. Yeah, it's that Java ring pulling you through the air. I think Sun, as we look back, really was at the forefront of something that has happened, that has now become global. What was, in 1982, was that really the vision? Was that really what you all were thinking?
Absolutely. We called it distributed computing back then. And, mm-hmm. and you know, IBM was mainframe centralized computing, and DEC called their mini computers distributed computing. Really?
Well, you could put one in your office, kind of.
I always loved DEC. They could fib in one word. They called it open VMS.
Yeah, right.
I always thought, how do you fib in one word?
Open
VMS. That was always my... Anyhow, I learned the if you didn't have an ad budget, just give the media something to write about.
Yeah.
We were way ahead of our time, too far ahead of our time, in many, many cases. But you know, I would rather innovate and create. And by the way, we were wildly successful by any measure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Unless you take, you know, but people tend to forget that. And I would love to have still been running, Sun, but. You know what? My dad worked awfully hard. I actually worked as hard, or maybe harder than he did, and I just didn't want to miss the. You know, when my boys were 2, 4, 6, and 8, I couldn't leave four boys alone.
No kidding, your poor wife. Yeah. Yeah.
I understand boys. As I used to say, my dad could have come home and spanked me every night, whether he knew what I did or not, and I would not have held that against him.
We're talking to Scott McNeely, co-founder of Sun Microsystems, and of course the creator of so many quotes. In fact, I found an article by Charles Cooper from a few years back with a list of Scott McNeely quotes, and it is a long, great list. We'll talk about a few of those when we come back. Our sponsor today is Corning. Of course, you know the name Corning, the great glass works, the great manufacturer. They make all the optical cables, and now they make optical cables for you to use on your Thunderbolt and USB 3 devices. Corning can really improve your audio and video workflow with these strong, durable, and what I love the best, long. They go a long throw. Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 fiber optic cables. If you're into high-end video or photography or audio production or computing, if you just don't want your big noisy RAID array to be sitting next to you, your quiet computer, you got to get these Corning optical cables. They let you build a convenient workspace through a superior long-distance connection. Now, first of all, these are not your father's fiber optic cables. They're flexible. They're strong. You can twist them. You can tie them in a knot. And they go a lot farther than copper, up to 60 meters. That's 200 feet for Thunderbolt, 50 meters, 165 feet for USB 3. 165 feet. You could be sitting in your desk, and that noisy hard drive with the fans running and the vibrations can be down the hall. And that's why it's so often used in studios and in recording environments where sound is important. And Corning's cables are hot swappable. And you can, of course, daisy chain up to 6 Thunderbolt devices. You can bend them. You can even walk on them. I remember when we first set up our SAN and had fiber optic cables, those orange cables, and they said, Russell said, do not step on these. They were in the ceiling. I wasn't going to step on them. They were way up there. Do not step on these, because everybody was concerned, but not anymore. These Corning cables, Corning nose glass, they are so tough. They're ultra slim. You can tie them in a knot. You can tie them in a bow. Did you know that Universal Audio uses optical cables by Corning to achieve acoustic isolation in their studio when they test new equipment? Like their new best-selling Thunderbolt audio interfaces. It's good enough for Universal. It's good enough for you. You should be using these. Instead of investing on multiple extenders and adapters and cables, just trust Corning. Establish the connection you need with one simple, thin, long cable. Corning's products are available at all major electronics and professional AV retailers, Apple stores, Amazon, B&H, and everywhere else. Corning's cables, longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to corning.com/twit. Oh, I like this. And save up to $130 on Thunderbolt optical cables. I'm already using them on my Radic array, but I'm going to get some more. This promotion is valid only from June 1st to July 31st or while supplies last. If they run out, that's it. So don't waste any time. Run to corning.com/twit and get an amazing deal on their unbeatable Thunderbolt cables. We thank Corning so much for our support of Triangulation. Scott McNeely is our guest. Hereditary enemy of Microsoft. Did you have, now that it's the wars are over, you and Bill Gates have a collegial relationship? Is it still a hairball?
No, we always. I mean, to me, I like hockey because, you know, everybody chirps during the game,
right.
You know, pokes fun at ancestry and those sorts of things. But at the end of the game, they get together and they shake hands. And I understand capitalism is the highest and most refined art of warfare, that where the byproduct of economic warfare is products, goods and services. It's jobs, it's self-esteem, it's taxes paid. It is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And nobody gets hurt. Now, you may get inconvenienced because one company beat another, or you get laid off, or you have to go retool or whatever. Those are all wonderful things. And so I consider, I've always said about Bill Gates being a monopolist, he was, you know, we all are in the blocks. We come out of the blocks. We chase that little rabbit in the dog race around the track, you know, and the guy driving the cart keeps the little rabbit at the end of the cart pole there ahead of the dog. So the dogs are chasing and running as hard as they can. Well, if a dog is smart enough, fast enough, clever enough to grab a hold of the rabbit and climb into the cart and drive fast enough so that the other dogs can't see the rabbit anymore, the race stops, and then we don't have all of the benefits of capitalism. That's called monopoly. That is the one wart in the economic system. I studied economics. I actually read the Antitrust Act, the Sherman Antitrust Act. Very few CEOs or analysts have ever even read the Antitrust Act. It is the wart in capitalism. Bill Gates, bless his heart, was the fastest dog. He might have been lucky. He might have been good. He might have, you know, jumped over the fence and waited for the rabbit to come around the other side. He did. He got it. But you know what you do? You don't shoot the dog.
Right.
You don't criminalize him. And I never was happy that people were criminalizing the world's best executives and the most successful companies. That's just not right. Now, you might want to break them up, but you don't hurt the shareholder doing it. And you don't arrest. Bill Gates should be in bronze on the steps of the Department of Commerce, and he should have been made the Secretary of Commerce as opposed to criminalized. That's what's wrong with our antitrust, and nobody talks about it. Nobody understands that. And by the way, if it is too big to fail, it ought to be broken up. Yeah. And that's another thing our government doesn't understand. So there's a bunch of moronic attitudes about antitrust and big corporations. I believe in competition. And you know what? If I get too big, break me up, make me start all over and do another race. There's nobody wants to watch a bunch of dogs milling around in the infield.
I love it. Bill Gates is the dog that caught the rabbit, the greyhound that caught the rabbit. I agree 100%. That makes perfect sense. And yet you were a strong competitor when that race was being run.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I look at the innovation that Bill Gates and Larry Ellison and John Chambers and Sun Microsystems and all the rest of us had back in, you know, in
amazing.
The 80s and 90s.
Amazing.
And you know, none of this new stuff, Uber, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, none of this other stuff would have been able to happen without us building out that enabling technology. So, you know, more power to them. They all lasted a little longer than I did, but we also drove open interfaces, which made the barrier to exit away from our technology a little lower. But that was, I think, a huge advantage.
Well, and I think in the long run, that's a race that you're going to win. I mean, Sun obviously is not going to win, but that open systems are going to win. It's pretty clear now as we head into the cloud decade that it's open is where it's at. And I even Microsoft seems to be starting to acknowledge that.
Absolutely. Satya used to work at Sun, so I think he understands that.
I forgot that. That's right.
Yeah. So there, you know, he's been infected with the word share, you know, and I think share is a wonderful and important word. In fact, that informs my Kariki investment is we're providing free and open K-12 educational materials. We spend between $8 and $15 billion a year on K-12 educational materials. Why? It's $130 for a third grade math textbook. Nothing's changed since Newton got hit on the head with an apple.
It's insane.
Plus 10 was, is, and will be 20 forever. And we're doing it online. Have you ever seen anybody read a textbook and all of a sudden jump up and scream, yes? No, but think about gamifying, thinking about having real-time scoring, and think about letting, instead of no child left behind, how about no parent, teacher, or child held back because they can move at their own pace? The upside-down classroom is a huge win where you read your lectures, you watch your lectures on your iPad, and rather than seeing a lecture from somebody who's not any good, get the lecture from the best third-grade math teacher. Watch it at home, then go into school and do your homework with the teacher there to help you. If you get stuck, you know, I can't help my kids with their homework. Are you kidding me? They are so far ahead of wherever I got. And to be able to have them go to school and get help and then go as fast as they can at home. If they want to watch 30 lectures, let them watch 30 lectures, go in, and the teacher can help them through the homework. And all of a sudden, you have no parent, teacher, or child held back. And the cost of curriculum goes to zero, effectively. So that's what we're trying to drive with Kariki. Again, it was Kim Jones, who runs Kariki for me. She was running our education business. And we were sitting in Europe, and we were talking about open source and free. And we said, why aren't textbooks this way? And that's how we got Kariki started. It started inside of Sun, and then we spun it out. And it's now, I think, the largest repository for free and open source. So www.curriki.org, Curriculum Wiki. It's a great, if you have a teacher or a student or whatever, have them check it out. And did I mention it's free?
Yeah, I love that. Let's talk about the role of technology in education, because I think a lot of school districts think that means buying an iPad for every kid in class. Although I do agree with you, we're starting to see more flipping the classroom, not nearly enough. What is the state of the art right now? What's going on in classes these days?
This is a really interesting intertwined conversation we're having here, at least from my perspective. I hope your viewers like it. Monopoly is the wart. And so,
in this case, the teachers' union monopoly? Or
Who is the biggest monopolist out there? The government.
Ah.
All right. So now we have government sector, union, teachers driving the architecture, the process, all the rest of it. Meanwhile, technology is going up, up, and away.
Right. In their defense, I would say education, rightly so, I think, should move slowly, because we've seen it in the past become very faddish and adopt fads. And really, the kids that grow up with whole language, for instance, My daughter cannot spell at the age of 24 because of the fad for 5 years while she was in grade school of whole language. So I understand why they might want to move slowly.
Whose fad was that? That was a government fad.
Of course, yeah.
So that's my point.
And, yeah, and no, I agree with you.
The private sector will kill dumb ideas so fast.
Yeah.
And the innovation can happen. You know, there's two issues around education. Who defines the product? And then secondly, who funds it? And we tend to get those two things confused. And when people say, you know, you don't believe in public education. I don't believe in public government education. I don't believe in government education. I think the government is a disaster. Do I believe in government funding? That's a different conversation. I don't even want to get into that. I personally find it a bit of wrong when somebody who doesn't have kids has to fund people who do have kids. But that's a different argument, and that gets everybody all bent out of shape. I tend to be more about personal responsibility rather than communal, as in communist. I'm not going to say that.
Oh, you said it. Too late.
No, I didn't finish it. Stuff the back of my mind.
No, I love it. Keep going.
So anyhow, but I do believe that the private sector ought to implement the product of educating, training, and you know, the fact that we don't have a good trades education environment is because everybody's trapped in public school. Not everybody is going to be the president of the United States. And we need to understand we need electricians and carpenters and woodworkers and all kinds of stuff. And yet our education system just says everybody deserves the chance to be the next Bill Gates or the next Barack Obama. And it's just, we're not all wired that way.
Yeah, it's become, especially in California, very clear our schools have failed our kids. And I agree with you. I mean, people need to learn the skills to make a living. That's pretty important.
I've been on social media, on Twitter and stuff, talking about chase a job, don't chase a dream. And, you know, everybody goes, oh, that's terrible. We're supposed to. I hear all these great and wonderful people saying, chase your dreams.
Right.
The heck with that. I've got my four boys. I got them chasing jobs. I said, you want to go to college, get a technical degree. Get something that you can get a job for after. And I was having this conversation with a guy at the bar, and he said, oh, yeah, my son's chasing his dreams. I go, what's he doing? He's down in L.A. tending bar, and he wants to be a playwright in Hollywood and all the rest of it. But I'm happy for him. He's chasing his dreams. And I got a little upset. I'd had a beer. And I said, you know what? While your kid's chasing his dream, my four boys are chasing jobs, and they're going to be ending up subsidizing your kid's dream chasing. And I don't think that's fair, and I don't think that's right. And I think if we all chase a job, make a lot of money, now I can chase a dream like open source education. And I can do that without asking anything of anybody else. Given that I chased a job, worked hard, and built some assets up where I can go and give back and donate and chase dreams later on. And my dream was to raise four boys. And I was able to go do that when I could afford it. I don't think I could start over and recreate what I did. I got a little lucky. Everybody gets a little lucky, but I worked awfully darn hard. And I borrowed nothing other than $15,000 from my dad to buy my son Microsystems stock, and I paid him off.
That was a pretty good investment.
Yeah, he actually invested a little too. So he did that.
Dad was probably pretty happy about how that all worked out.
Yeah.
I want to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about Oracle, Google, because you must have some opinions on that. And you know, I've talked to a few people now about it, including James Gosling. We talked to Jonathan Schwartz a few years ago, and I'm curious what your take is on all of this when we continue. Scott McNeely, our guest, chairman and CEO of Weigh-In, founder of that incredible startup, Kariki. Really, really exciting. And, of course, former chairman and CEO of Sun Microsystems. More in a moment. Our show today brought to you by this little doohickey. I love this. This is so cool. Talk about open. Did you know there's a port in your car, underneath the steering wheel? If your car was built since 1996, it will not cover that Gremlin X. No. But if your car was built since 1996, it has an onboard diagnostic port, the OBD2 port. And it's open, it's available. And, you know, every time I saw it, and you don't really see it, but it is there. I thought, well, that's for the tech at the dealership to diagnose a repair, right? Well, no. It turns out you can use it too if you get one of these. This plugs right into it. It's easy to do. Then pairs to your phone using Bluetooth. And now all of a sudden you can see on your phone all of this information on the automatic app. I mean, you can see what the engine's doing. You see how much gas you're using. You can see when you have hard braking, fast acceleration, exceeding a speed limit. This is all in there. You can even see what that check engine light means, just like the guy at the dealership. What's that code? And then it will show you where you can get repairs. I love this automatic. It's getting better and better. This is version 2.0. It keeps track of your fuel mileage, your vehicle health. You can expense business trips with a tap. You can link your car to the connected devices in your life, including your Amazon Echo, if this, then that, your Hue lights, your Hue lights can dim when you leave the house and brighten when you come back or whatever it is. I use automatic, integrate it with if this, then that, to announce when I arrive at the studio. It tweets for me. My automatic tweets, Leo's just pulled up. Let's get a show going. I love this thing. And by the way, if you've got teenagers, it's very useful not only to keep an eye on them, but to help them be better drivers. You see that? It works with your Apple Watch. It works with your Pebble. Easy to install. Works with iPhone or Android. Their commute analyzer determines when you should leave for your destination and how you can save money by making your commute more efficient. But I get a grade for every trip I take. And, as far as fuel economy, how well I drove it, whether I hard braked or accelerated. And, you know, I also have a little script that puts it into my Evernote. So every trip I've got a map, I've got all the information. And here's something interesting, exactly how much gas I used, you know, how much it costs, because it knows where you got your gas and what the cost was. It's super smart. They even have a 24/7 crash response feature. So put this in your teen's car and you'll feel safe knowing that it's keeping your loved ones safe on the road at all times. I love it. There's no monthly fee. There's no subscription. It's just $99.95. But if you go right now to automatic.com, you're going to save 30% off your automatic adapter and get free shipping. What a deal that is. Automatic.com. 30% off right now. Okay, let's continue on. Scott McNeely is my guest, husband, dad of four awesome boys, love taxpayers, capitalism, and personal responsibility. That's his Twitter bio. I think that's all fair. It's good to have you, Scott, on Triangulation. And let's get Scott some more followers on Twitter. He's at Scott
McNeely. No haters. I don't mind. I don't mind a different opinion, but no haters.
Twitter could be a great place for a kind of an open discussion and conversation with people of like and unlike minds. Instead, it turns into this kind of just throwing mud, and it's a shame because there's opportunity there.
The anonymity breeds a little irresponsibility.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Oracle, Google. I'm sure you're following all this with interest. When we talked to James Gosling not so long ago, maybe a month ago, he said, at the time we felt like Google had kind of slimed us, but we weren't ready to sue over it.
So, the case, I guess, is going to probably get appealed. I've been deposed in the case, and my argument is that the copyright work and the APIs, it's a huge volume of very detailed architectural and API specs, that is IP, that's intellectual property. And one can decide to make it open, to open source it, to make it freely available or partially available. There's many different licensing models, open source licensing models, and you can choose. As somebody who creates that architecture and document, you should have the right to choose whether or not you make it licensable or not. And at Sun, we licensed all of that stuff and the brand, and we asked Google for a license and they refused. So by my view, companies ought to be less than totally open, totally free and open, like public domain open. They can choose any level of non-public domain open, and rights equivalent to ownership were never granted to anybody with Java technology. So My view is that Oracle has a very strong case, and one that I support, which says a company who owns technology ought to be able to choose how it is licensed and whether it's free and open. Now, personally, I always was about sharing, and I thought sharing was a good thing and a great thing. It was a great thing economically, but it was also a good thing to do, especially when you're talking about the written and spoken language of computing, which is such a great enabler. Let's talk about drugs just as a side analogy. You know, if drug formulas were, because it's important to everybody, were made free and open, nobody would invest. Without IP, without copyright, without patent law, there is not a return on the investment made in the R&D and certification process. And both drugs and technology have huge in R&D and certification processes. The thing that will kill more people than anything is drug price controls and lack of patent protection for the innovators. And so the same sort of thing will kill innovation in technology if we have no, and I know a lot of people argue against software patents, all the rest of it. There needs to be some intellectual property protection and waiting period before anybody else can just rip off your technology, or there'll be no return on the investment made. And people don't sit down and think through that argument enough in the popular media. I think the deeper thinkers have certainly understood there's a bigger issue here.
Well, and it was absolutely understood by our founding fathers. That's why the patent system was created. This notion that you invest in something and then you own it for a limited period of time, and then in the patent process you expose how it's done so that when that patent expires, others can now learn and build on your creations. That seems a fair way to do it. Is patent better than copyright when it comes to software?
Well, you know, I'm not a lawyer. There's many different ways, and you know, in the same way that there's many different ways to license technology, there's many different laws that can be written to protect intellectual property. And you know, copyright tends to be less product and service oriented and more creative protection, that sort of thing, to people who create using different languages. So it's all complicated, and it's hard. It's hard for a jury to really understand that, especially as they come from a government sector, union teacher educated, and tenure professor educated backgrounds. So how can a tenured professor teach me about capitalism? Right. Seriously? I mean, it's just...
He's got a job for life. By the way, my dad is a tenured professor. I'm not going to say anything against tenure.
Yeah. Have lunch or be lunch, or if you're a tenured professor, do lunch, you know?
You once said that not about 4 or 5 years after its release, that the iPod was basically like your answering machine. It will be hard to sell an iPod. You said this in 2006, 5 or 7 years from now, when every cell phone can access your entire music library. I'm sure in 2006, people thought you were crazy, and now you've been proven right. It just took a little longer, maybe. Yeah, there you go. There's your phone.
So there's my phone, and I have a cover, and I'm down to 3 cards still in it. My driver's license, which is ridiculous. That should be part of my – and then I have 2 credit cards.
I think we're really rapidly approaching getting rid of those, yeah.
And then I don't carry a flashlight around with me.
Right.
I don't wear a watch, you know. And I said that a long time ago that, you know, fundamentally this would become your electronic wallet. And at some point we'll just embed in your jawbone your phone. And you just won't even have to carry this around. You know, you just answer that way.
Yeah. The more I read of your early pronouncements, the more I realize you knew it ahead of time. Maybe was Sun ahead of its time? You said that earlier.
Yeah, just too often, way too far. And I blame James Gosling and Wayne Rosen. And
it was just too Eric damn smart.
Schmidt. There were a lot of very, very smart people there. And, probably my fault that I didn't. I mean, we actually missed some big things, too. We had Route D, the Unix utility, running on SunOS on Motorola chips, and that was the original router. I didn't understand what a router was. I didn't know that, you know, I didn't know store and forward was like a thing that you wanted to go do a lot of. But China built its first internet on Sun computers. They took our monitors off our workstations and just used them as routers. Well, along came Cisco, and they said, well, why don't we just really make a unique purpose router? And they ended up, you know, we missed the whole router switch business. Not that we were failing at the time. We were busier than you can believe. But, you know, I think that's one of the things Eric has done it, has influenced, and Larry and Sergey have been influenced by, is Google didn't get constrained by search as being, hey, that's our business. You know, too many times these tenured professors say, stay focused.
Right.
Google didn't stay focused.
Right.
They're building cars now. They're mapping the world. They're, you know, doing all of these different things. You know, then they saw to buy YouTube. Who'd have thought YouTube? Remember when they bought them for $1.8 billion when they had no revenue? And look at it.
And it looked like YouTube was going to be sued out of existence by all the television networks.
Yeah.
I remember talking to Steve Chen at the time saying, you dodged a bullet. you were NBC was about to put you out of business.
Yeah. So, I think we could have maybe done a better job of monetizing, but, you know, Sun had a very, very strong, creative, sharing, open, innovative culture that, I don't know, there were 235,000 ex-Sun folks. And I think if you asked them, you'd get a 99% plus approval rating that was the most fun place they ever worked.
I think you're right. Should Sun still be alive today? I mean, should it still be around? Was there a place where it took a wrong turn?
I blame my wife. we have four boys, and I just said, you know, I want to go do that, and I'm just hoping that'll be more leveraged down the road, and that these four boys will do great and wonderful things.
See what I gave up for you, kids. See,
I did give up the greatest job in the world, but you know what? I'm having fun with Weigh-In. I'm having fun with Kariki. I'm doing advisory work for dozens of companies. It's like going to business school class and doing a business school case that really matters every day. It's not fake. And I'm enjoying caddying for my boys. I'm enjoying developing them and training them. And life couldn't be much better.
It's hard to have work-life balance in Silicon Valley.
I was always balanced. I was in marketing. I was in sales. I was doing engineering. I was in Europe. I was in
Asia. I'm not talking about that, Scott. Very balanced. I would take my 80-hour work week and divide it very equally among all the divisions. But you don't have any regrets. I think, gosh, you know, in some ways you've had the best of both worlds, haven't you?
Oh, I cannot believe how lucky I've been. I'd basically given up on getting married. I was 38 years old, and I was traveling around the world, staring out the window of a 747. And I thought I'd never get married. And I got lucky and met the gal of my dreams. I've got four awesome kids. So I've got everything now.
Yeah. Your wife's in the other room, isn't she?
No, I don't know her. Okay. She's walking.
Okay.
She's walking the dish at Stanford with one of her buddies. So that's why it's so quiet.
Bill Joy once said that Sun tried to buy Apple once, and Apple almost merged with Sun on two other occasions. What was and yet at the same time, I feel like there was some competition. What was your relationship with Steve and Apple?
I've known Steve for a long, long time, and the next days and all the rest of it. And that's a true statement. We got very close. At one point, we were about to put the two companies together, and an investment banker basically messed it up. And you know what? I'm sort of glad, because I'm very aware of my own limitations. There's no way I would have done with Apple what Steve Jobs did with Apple on his second comeback. I mean, it was, it's a good thing that we didn't buy them.
Yeah,
we'd have messed them up. We were we were industrial. They were retail. We were B2B and they were B2C, and it's two very, very different businesses.
It's funny though, because I mean, I know you tried to move them to Spark, and in the long run, I mean, they've basically moved to BSD, and that was under Steve's, you know, by acquiring Next.
I still think Apple has a huge Achilles heel. And that is iOS being proprietary versus Android being open. Mm-hmm. And, you know, granted, we didn't do it, but Google did it. And, you know, Eric and the gang said, hey, we'll open source Android. And if you look at the unit volumes of Android versus, now granted, proprietary, if you can win with proprietary, it is far more profitable than open. But at some point, open wins, and you'll have to face the, I always get nervous, too, when companies are building a brand new headquarters.
Uh-huh. Isn't that like getting on the cover of Sports Illustrated?
Exactly, exactly.
It's kind of a jinx. And here at Facebook, it almost looks like Facebook and Apple are competing to build the most ostentatious corporate headquarters. And then Google wanted to, but got kind of shut down by the city council.
I love Face. I love, you know, Zuck, and I know a bunch of folks over at Facebook, but he always talks about how he leaves the Sun logo up on their headquarters buildings to remind people of what can happen if they can get complacent.
And
I kind of disagree with that. I think that ought to remind Facebook that, you know, you can inspire with innovation and do some really great and enabling things with innovation, as opposed to thinking like Sun Microsystems was a failure. I mean, Oracle's doing pretty well with the technology themselves, and they continue to grow and gain share out there.
Is there, sometimes I feel like there's just a very quick business cycle in technology, quicker than normal, but there's always been a business cycle, and it's the innovator's dilemma. You know, do you not believe in that? Could IBM?
I totally believe in it.
Yeah, I think so. There's just a natural cycle.
Have lunch or be lunch, and if you do the analysis of the Fortune 500, it is always turning over, always has been.
And it should be.
And it's probably turning over way faster. I haven't done the analysis recently. It's turning over way faster now. That's good. The problem is with monopolies. They don't turn over.
Right.
And we don't turn our government over or upside down enough. And there's a whole bunch of departments that exist, secretaries of whatever, that don't belong. And we never shut down anything in the government. It's just like a big blob that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and eventually takes over. And, you know, we're hurtling towards 50% of the GDP in the government sector. That's scary to me.
I know you were a supporter of Mitt Romney. Do you feel like government should be run more like business?
I've always said the world's worst CEO is 1,000 times better than the best politician. And Mitt Romney was one of the greatest CEOs. We'll never have a chance to vote for a better human. Maybe we will, but I can't imagine. The guy was a family man. He had high integrity. He'd been on the government as well as the private sector, successful in both. He was a very charitable guy, just smart as all get out, really understood how things work. And we decided, no, that didn't make sense. We don't the popularity contest. He wasn't a TV ready candidate. So, you know, he loses. And, you know, now we've got one of the I wouldn't call him one of the world's greatest CEOs. I mean, Donald is not one of the world's. But, you know, you look at, do we want to go socialism or do we want to go a hardened politician? You know, a career hardened politician. I just think, you know,
you're going to support Trump.
You know, at this point, I'm thinking we need somebody who's a little bit of a glass breaker. And you
not
know,
Gary Johnson, not the Libertarian Party.
Well, I mean, I'm very socially liberal and very fiscally conservative.
Yeah.
And there's nobody to vote for that has a chance of getting elected. And so the question is, do you want to grow the beast? And,
right.
You know, Bernie and Hillary are going to grow the beast and harden it and make it more corrupt and more stifling and more of a monopoly.
Trump would shake things up. I think there's no doubt about that.
Trump's going to break things.
He's going to break a lot of things.
Good things, and he's going to break some bad things.
Yeah.
But do you want to build it up and harden it, or take a chance that he's going to break more bad things than he's going to break good things? And I think that's the dilemma that most intelligent voters are evaluating. There's a lot of people who are voting for a living. And, you know, Bernie's your man if you just want, you know, if you want redistribution. But I warn you to go study your history books and see where a government, a planned economy, what it has done to your personal liberties and freedoms, And show me a planned economy, and I'll show you an economy that has very few billionaires. And so if you want incoming equality, just check out East Berlin, Russia, North Korea, and huge parts of China, and you will see what income equality brings.
Did your dad work with George Romney, Mitt's dad?
And George was the CEO of American Motors when my dad got hired in, so he interviewed with him.
I just realized there might be this connection. And you went to Cranbrook with
Mitt,
right?
To Cranbrook. Yeah. He's older than me, so he was there before
wasn't
I was.
Wasn't at the same time. Okay.
Wasn't exactly the same time.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. He's a good man.
You don't think income inequality is a problem going forward in this country?
No. You know, if we were all born equally capable, and if we all worked equally hard, and we all had two biological parents raising, if we all came from equal circumstances, then I would expect income equality. Absolutely. But it isn't the way it is. It isn't the way it works. And, you know, that's like visualizing world peace. Really? I grew up walking down the street in Detroit. I did not visualize world peace. I visualized problems around every corner and was ready to bolt.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the way it is.
Actually, what about Detroit? What should we do about Detroit? Do you have any interest in that? That's your hometown.
I think the UAW killed the city, but that's my own personal view. And please don't give out my home address on that one. I promised that I would retire from Sun if we ever got unionized, because I think pitting workers against management creates a huge war and blows a company up. And so that's why I think most ex-Sun employees will always say it was the best place they ever worked, because we treated everybody as a teammate, everybody as part of the. And I always believed in the upside down org chart, where all the management worked for the employees who were the ones getting the work done.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need that kind of philosophy and attitude, not the the union was in it for itself, not for the advancement of transportation or for the success of its companies. And it ended up, you know, as sort of a parasite that kind of killed the host.
We're going to take a break, come back with Scott McNeely, and we got to ask him about his most famous quote of all: you already have zero privacy, get over it. And he said that a long time ago, more than 10 years ago. And I wonder what he thinks of today's privacy situation. We're going to take a break, come back with a lot more. Let's talk about DigitalOcean. Man, is this great. This is the coolest thing. You know, even a few years ago, if I wanted to play with, let's say, Ruby on Rails or Django or React or Node or any of the cool web frameworks, I would either have to start a web server at home, but then I couldn't really see how it was going to be on the web, or I would go and I would go to my hosting company and I'd say, can you spin up a server? And they'd get back to me a few days later saying it's running, and it just was a pain in the butt. Let me get my laptop out, because I want to show you how awesome DigitalOcean is. If you're a developer and you want to inexpensively spin up, let me go to DigitalOcean.com and log into my account here. Spin up a server for a variety of uses. This is totally empowering for the developer. I'm just going to log into my DigitalOcean account here. There we go. And let's create an instance. What do you want to do? So here's how it works. They call them droplets, but really it's an SSD-based server. I'm going to create a new droplet right now. You get to choose what OS: Ubuntu, FreeBSD, Fedora, Debian, Core OS, CentOS. Or this is what I love. I go to one-click apps, and you're ready to go. You're going to be provisioned with any one of these: Cassandra, Docker. Docker, by the way, is a great place to start. Then you can do anything else with that, right? Django, Drupal. They've got LampStacks. They've got LempStacks. They've got MeanStacks, MediaWiki, MongoDB, even WordPress, Redis. Let's do a Ruby on Rails setup. What do you say? So I'm going to do Ruby on Rails, and that includes Postgres and Nginx as my server, which is really nice. Now, here's the really thing I love. Choose the size. So for $5 a month or 0.7 cents an hour, And I love doing it that way because then, you know, then you just pay for what you use. You can get a CPU, a half gig of RAM, 20 gig SSD, and a gigabyte of transfer. Choose your region. I always choose San Francisco because we're here in Northern California. But look, they're all over the world, including Bangalore and Toronto and Amsterdam and Singapore and London and Frankfurt. You want to turn on backups? It's just a checkbox. Weekly backups cost a little more. Private networking, you want that? Boom. IPv6, you want that? Here's what I always turn on. I attach it to my SSH key. So that way I can get a console. Yes, you get a root console as part of this deal, and I don't even have to enter a password. It's more secure that way. I just use my SSH key. You can say how many droplets. You can choose your own host name. Now watch. I'm pressing the create button, and you can watch while I continue on. I love DigitalOcean, and we know so many people who use it, lots of developers, 600,000 developers, including Father Robert. He has a WordPress instance, among other things. I'm sure he's running Docker. Randall Schwartz, of course. Knowing Randall, he's probably got a lamp stack going with Perl, and Aaron Newcomb uses it. I just love this idea. It is literally right now provisioning my server. There's a great community, too, with pages and tutorials for pretty much anything you can do with your droplet. So if you want to set up a mail server, there's a page with a cookbook recipe that'll walk you through it. It's just fantastic. So boom, boom, and we're done. Look at that. I have a server with a public IP address. I have console login. Let's log into the console, and just in case you don't believe me. Now that's a Ruby on Rails server running right now, and it's logging in and starting up. And that is about as easy as can be. DigitalOcean. I tell you what, we're going to give you your first 2 months free. Go to digitalocean.com. Here's what you'll do. Create an account, and they're going to send you an email. You confirm your email. And then when you've got that all set up, go to the billing section and enter the promo code triangulation. And we're going to give you a $10 credit. Or 2 months, plenty to get started and explore what DigitalOcean can do. And you know what? If you're learning something, like I was learning Clojure, and I really wanted to have a server running Clojure, this is so easy. Such a great way to do it. DigitalOcean.com. Use the offer code TRIANGULATION and get a $10 credit. This is the kind of thing that really is transforming the ecosystem so that you have an idea for practically nothing. You've got a server like next in 5 minutes. DigitalOcean.com. Get your $10 credit by using the promo code TRIANGULATION. Scott McNeely is my guest, founder and former CEO, chairman of Sun Microsystems. Right now, he runs Way In, a marketing startup, and also Curriki, which is a really great idea, a kind of a combination of curriculum and wiki, a free and open community for teachers and students using open source software to replace the highly proprietary and very expensive system we've got now. Scott, I'm so glad we could spend this time with you. I'm sure every interview you do, somebody brings this up, and I hate to be the one that's going to do it this time, but it's kind of timely, right? This is a big conversation we're having right now with the crypto conversation and privacy. Is it over still? Was it over then, and is it over now?
Yeah, I mean, there's almost no way. You know, we were talking earlier about, you know, this has become our wallet now. And, you know, the thing is, your telephone company knows everywhere you go. They know every application you're running. They know when you use those applications. They know what you're buying. I mean, they have access. You think about how much Google knows about you. Uber, you know, used to be able to take a cab, but Uber is so convenient, so easy, but they know everywhere you go. You don't have privacy. Every transaction, I use cash almost never.
Yeah.
I just carry one bill in my thing because I don't want, and I use that just as an absolute emergency. But so somebody knows just about everything that you do at every moment of the day. And that's, you know, the cable companies know what you watch. It's obvious. It's
yes.
Obvious. You have no privacy.
It's
get
obvious.
Over it.
Yeah, get over it.
So now what do you do about it?
That's the follow-up question. Yeah.
Is it scary that Google or AT&T or Uber knows about me? Or is it scary that the government knows about me?
Right.
And, you know, it's actually very, very scary when I think about the fact that I get audited regularly every year. and they don't ever find anything, but, you know, they follow my Twitter account, and then all of a sudden I get audited. I was talking to a billionaire who said he has the same problem. He gets audited every time, and they never find anything. But, you know, somebody once asked me, why don't they audit people who don't pay taxes? not the ones who are paying a lot. Well, whatever. I digress. Back to the topic.
Well, no, but part of the reason this is germane is because it seems the barrier between Google and your AT&T and the government has become porous. And Google obviously isn't happy about that. But all this information that is being collected by these private companies is really ultimately becoming available to the government.
Well, that gets all back to what is the role of government? And if the role of government is to do your health care, to do your education, to do your insurance, to do your student loans, to do all of these, your housing, food stamps, you know, up to 50 million people. Do we seriously have 50 million people? And we got an obesity problem, and we're giving out $50 million worth of, or 50 million people food. The government has gotten into a self-preservation and grow the bureaucracy and attack their political enemies mode that we didn't have 50 years ago. And so it gets very, very scary to me. And when I said you have no privacy, get over it, I was talking about don't worry about businesses, because you can move away from one business to another business.
Right.
And that's why I'm a firm believer in breaking up monopolies. And if they're too big to fail, break them up. Well, the thing that needs to be broken up is the big government. It is too big to fail in so many areas of our lives, because the one thing that we want the government to do, and that the founders and the framers of our Constitution wanted to do, was protect our individual liberties and freedoms and our rights. What is a right? It's something you can give everyone without taking from anybody. Free speech is a right. Free health care or free college is not. Bernie, that's not a right. That's a redistributive and tyranny leading slippery slope to get on. And we're on that slippery slope. And then when government can have access to all of this data, there is no way to be anonymous. There's no way. I mean, I might as well publish my political views on Twitter, because you know what? The government's going to find out anyhow.
So, okay. I mean, one of the roles, and I think everybody could agree, of government would be to protect us.
Yes.
And the notion that the government is getting this information is ostensibly, anyway, to protect us against terrorism. That's appropriate,
absolutely,
right?
And it's wonderful. But the problem is that we can't trust the government not to share that with the IRS,
right,
or with the student loan department or with the health care providers or all of the other things, because they have so much influence. That's why I'm an absolute believer in small government. That comes from my libertarian conservative views of keep government. They're protecting our individual liberties and rights and freedoms. And the reason I tend to vote Republican more than Democrat is that I believe without economic freedoms and liberties and small government, you can't have individual and personal freedoms and liberties. Because I just don't see those individual personal freedoms and liberties in North Korea or in China, or they certainly didn't exist in East Berlin versus West Berlin. So I tend to vote for economic freedoms, because that's the only way you can have personal freedoms and liberties.
So I think sometimes that quote, you have zero privacy, get over it, is interpreted as cheering for that. It's not that you're cheering for the lack of privacy, just that acknowledging that's the case. It's over anyway, no matter what.
And to me, that's the fundamental reason why you want small government. And by the way, You don't want to be off the grid. There are some huge advantages when businesses know who you are. And I don't mind getting spammed with soft spike golf shoe advertisements, or the new latest driver, or, you know, some new hockey equipment that I could buy for my boys. That's information to me. And if businesses know that, and they don't, I don't need to know about what's playing at the opera. I'm not going. Don't spam me with that stuff.
I think,
right?
If there's a failure, and the reason that people don't like tracking, so-called tracking, is because it does such a bad job, and you still get the opera ads. If it did a good job and you'd only see ads for stuff you're interested in, I think everybody would say, hey, this is working. I don't mind this. It's working pretty good.
Spam is stuff you don't want, not stuff that you can use. And you know, you actually do learn stuff. My son loves watching car ads. It's not spam. It's not spam to him.
Scott, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you for spending some time with us. Are you going off to the golf course next?
No. I've got three advisors I'm meeting with this afternoon and then a Kirky board meeting this afternoon.
Kirky is such a great idea. I hope it continues to be successful, and I hope any teachers watching take advantage of this, and students too. C-U-R-R as in curriculum, I-K-I as in wiki, kirky.org. What a great idea. And you can, and it's a wiki, so you can put stuff there and you can get curriculum there and so forth.
You can also donate. There's a donate button.
Oh, yeah. Very important. Let's put the donate button. Help support Kirky as well. Thank you, Scott. It's really been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thanks, Leo. It's been fun.
We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We pre-recorded this because of WWDC. We wanted to have this air before our WWDC coverage. If you're watching this show on the 13th, stay tuned. If you're watching it on demand, bully for you. We encourage that. Of course, I know we have people watching on airplanes, on Air Canada and other airlines. If you want to get more, twit.tv/TRI. You can download every one of our hundreds of shows. All of the shows we do on the Twit Network are available on demand, not just from the website, but from your favorite podcast client, including, of course, your smartphone, right? You got it. It's all on your smartphone and Windows and Roku and even like XBMC and Kodi. Find Twit, subscribe. You don't want to miss an episode. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.